Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, sitting in for John Kiriakou. I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, all around the world, whistleblowers who expose the misdeeds of the rich and powerful are persecuted, but many countries have also adopted legislation to offer them some form of protection. Loud and Clear co-host John Kiriakou has been in Greece this week to address the Greek parliament and meet senior government officials as that country prepares to pass its first true whistleblower protection law. Next, the Department of Health and Human Services is reportedly planning to issue regulations that will further restrict undocumented people's ability to access healthcare. We'll take an in-depth look today and tomorrow at this latest attack on immigrants and the barriers to healthcare access that already existed. Then, we've all heard about GMOs or genetically modified foods, but new research has created what's being called GMO.2 or gene-edited food. What is this new creation, and is it any safer than GMO.1? And then, the US and the UK took the highly unusual step of issuing a joint technical alert this week, which says that Russia has hacked millions of personal and home technological devices. Is this true? What's the big picture? And finally, it's Friday, time for our regular look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. All around the world, whistleblowers who expose the misdeeds of the rich and powerful are persecuted, but many countries have also adopted legislation to offer them some form of protection. Loud and Clear co-host John Kiriakou has been in Greece this week to address the Greek parliament and meet senior government officials as the country prepares to pass its first true whistleblower protection law. Good to talk to you, John.
Oh, I'm so glad to be back. Good to talk to both you guys.
John, you sound happy. You sound relaxed. What's going on?
I am. Greece, first of all, just by its nature, is one of the most beautiful and glorious places on earth. And I don't say it lightly. I admit that I'm biased in favor of Greece, but it really is paradise. And then to come here and to be in political unison with the government on such an important issue as whistleblower protection just makes it all that much better.
So you spoke to the Greek parliament. Have you spoken or are you about to speak?
Already did that yesterday. And then in an hour, I'm going to sit on a panel with the head of Transparency International Greece and two other whistleblower advocates. And we just got word that three parliamentarians and the Minister of Justice are going to attend as well.
All right. John Kiriakou is our guest. He's normally our co-host. Walter Smolarek is filling in for him this week, along with Nicole Rossell. But we're talking to John from Greece because he is there at the invitation of the Greek parliament to speak to the people of Greece about this whistleblower protection bill, the first of its kind in Greece. What's in the bill?
Well, the bill would allow for whistleblowers to maintain their anonymity. And this has really been the sticking point over the last 2.5 years or so. They're not allowed, as the law is currently written, to testify in court if they remain anonymous. But the only way that you can really encourage people to go public with information that exposes waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality is to ensure their anonymity. Now, we had a stroke of luck, a real bit of luck this morning, when the OECD released a report saying that the only way to ensure that whistleblowers are protected is to demand anonymity. And it appears that the European Parliament is going to adopt this OECD report and that each individual member country of the European Union will adopt it as domestic law. So it looks like this thing is just about over, and I think whistleblowers all over Europe are going to be protected.
So what did you say in your speech to the Greek parliament? How are you received by the members of parliament?
Oh, very, very warmly, which is another reason that I love coming here so much. You know, it's funny. There's real unanimity on this issue. Everybody understands the need for whistleblowers, and it's also very topical. There was a whistleblower that came forward in Malta a couple of months ago, and she provided information on waste, fraud, and abuse in a bank there. She provided that information to a journalist, and the journalist was promptly assassinated. That whistleblower fled to Greece, and the Maltese government asked that she be arrested. Well, today, the Greek Supreme Court said that she is a legitimate whistleblower, she has not committed a crime, and that rather than being arrested, she should be protected. And so this is a giant leap forward, both for Greece and for whistleblowers all across the European Union. I really think the tide has changed.
We're speaking to John Kyriakou from Greece. John spoke before the Greek parliament yesterday. Normally he's here in studio as the co-host of Loud and Clear. When you think about it, John, you're warmly received. Well, first you're invited, and then you're warmly received in the Greek parliament for a whistleblower. And here,
right.
Here we are talking, as we do every day, just, you know, about a half a mile or three quarters of a mile from the Congress. I don't think you've ever been invited, but you did spend a stretch in prison because you blew the whistle on torture. What's Greece's view on torture?
The Greeks can't believe that a majority of the American people, which we see in every relevant poll, a majority of the American people actually supports a torture program. People are shocked when I tell them that. They can't imagine that that's really the case. And it's the sad truth. And Brian, as you said a second ago, on Capitol Hill, there's really very little support for whistleblowers. There are there's a small handful of people who are good on whistleblower issues. Ironically, they happen to be Republicans. People like Charles Grassley, a Republican senator from Iowa, or Rand Paul, a Republican senator from Kentucky. There's one or two members of the House, both Republicans. But even they are not seen to be in the mainstream of their party on this issue. There's a lot of work to do on whistleblower protection in the United States, far more work than there is to do in Europe. The Europeans are just about there. The Americans have a lot to learn.
When we're talking about torture, Europe is way ahead. When we're talking about whistleblowing, obviously Europe is about to go way ahead. John, yesterday we did a story, an 83-year-old man in Alabama was put to death, executed. Of course, in Europe, this would be, people are seriously against the death penalty, but putting to death, executing an 83-year-old for a crime committed 30 years ago. When you contrast the sensibilities in Europe to what we're doing here, the Americans like to think of the United States as the most advanced country in the world. But when you look at these issues, not so much.
Oh, not at all. As Americans, we should be ashamed of ourselves when we put an 83-year-old man to death for a crime committed 3.5 decades ago. In Europe, there is no such thing as the death penalty. And indeed, life in prison really means 25 years in prison because the Europeans believe in rehabilitation. And rehabilitation reduces recidivism. And everybody knows that. Everybody understands and recognizes that. I don't understand, though, why in the United States, people just don't get it. Now, if your point is to punish, that's one thing, but be honest about it. Don't pretend that you want to provide educations or job training or some sort of rehabilitation to make people not recidivize. That's just a joke, and you're only fooling yourself. So you're right, Brian, on issues like whistleblowing, on the death penalty, on prison reform, you know, access to assistance related to justice, the United States is far, far behind any member country of the European Union.
You know, on our show, we have advocates for the abolition of the death penalty. We have people who are fighting against police brutality and mass incarceration. You know, to bring about the kinds of changes that we're talking about now, you know, of course, in addition to the political will to do it, you need, you know, grassroots organizers and mobilizers. John, I'm sure you've gotten a chance to meet with many of those movement leaders, those civil society leaders in Greece who are pushing for protections for whistleblowers, against torture, for human rights. Tell us what that scene is like.
You know, it's funny, Walter, because everybody is in general agreement on these issues. I'm not encountering debates. I'm not encountering angry, differing opinions. Sure, you can have a different opinion. And their position is that every civilized country ought to have this same goal, that you protect people who are exposing waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety, because there's a greater good here. And that greater good really does help all of society. I don't know why the United States doesn't recognize that, but these European countries certainly do.
John Kyriakou, in our last 2 minutes, you're there in Greece. You go regularly. I'm sure you'd like to go more frequently. Greece has gone through such a tough time with austerity imposed, especially by the Northern European bankers. the people have suffered a lot. There's been a growing immiseration over the years because of these austerity policies. What's it like now compared, say, to the last time you were in Greece?
Oh, that's a great question. There's a dramatic turnaround. It's dramatically different from when I was last here 2 years ago. You know, 2 years ago, unemployment was about 30%. There was no end in sight to this economic collapse. And I think that Greece has actually turned a corner economically. Unemployment is down. It's still high. It's still about 24%, but it's down. The cafes are full of people having a coffee, sitting with friends, smoking a cigarette.
We're on our way. John, just stay where you are. We're coming.
This is the life. Guys, they really know how to enjoy life here, as bad as things get. And let me say one other thing about Greece and the Greek people and the Greek government. As bad as things were with the economic collapse, at exactly the same time, the country was flooded with refugees. And instead of turning to the far right, like so many other countries have, like Hungary, for example, or like Poland, the Greek people welcomed these refugees and provided them with food and shelter and medical care. And help to resettle someplace. So the Germans have taken a lot, the French and the British have taken a lot, but the Greeks have really welcomed these people as hard as it's been for them. They don't have the resources, but they did it anyway.
All right, we're going to leave it there, Walter. John Kiriakou, co-host of Loud and Clear, is in Greece this entire week. He was, as he told us, speaking before the Greek parliament in favor of a really important, far-reaching whistleblower protection bill. A bill that appears to will pass in Greece and could be a trendsetter, well, should be a trendsetter for the United States, although we're less optimistic about our parliament, also known as the U.S. Congress. Anyway, John, we look forward to seeing you next week. Walter, we're out of time.
Yeah, great to talk to you, John. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we're looking at healthcare for immigrant populations and the huge obstacles that immigrant families face right now. The Department of Health and Human Services is reportedly planning to issue regulations that will further restrict undocumented people's ability to access healthcare. We'll take a second part of an in-depth look today at this latest attack on immigrants and the barriers to healthcare access that already existed. We are joined in studio by Leo Cuello, an attorney and a director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Leo, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So we started this conversation yesterday about general coverage for immigrants, and I wanted to hear a little bit about how this healthcare varies by geography. This is essentially healthcare justice varying by where you live in the country. And I think right here in D.C. is an interesting example because we've got D.C., Virginia suburbs, Maryland suburbs, and all people living in the same area being treated really differently.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what's so fascinating about it is that the difference from D.C. to Maryland to Virginia is so stark. So the way I like to think of it is an analogy of you have to kind of use Medicaid to for the state to kind of build a dam, and then the state has to come in and plug the gaps of that dam. And so what we see on the front end is that D.C. and Maryland just do a better job building their Medicaid programs. So both states have taken up the Medicaid expansion. Virginia hasn't. Both states voluntarily raise income limits to bring more people into their Medicaid programs. So both states take up options to get more people covered. Virginia doesn't do it. But then when you talk about filling in the gaps of that dam, that's where D.C. really makes a name for itself. So when we talk about who's eligible for Medicaid, we're usually talking about federally funded Medicaid. But states also can commit their own state dollars to doing this. And it turns out there are about a half a dozen states that do this, and D.C. is one of them. So D.C. runs two programs, the D.C. Healthcare Alliance and the D.C. Immigrant Children's Program. And both of these programs will cover immigrants who are not eligible for Medicaid and so are otherwise being left out of the system. And the upshot of this is that if you go to Maryland, which is a great blue state, you've got in the Latino population about 27% of the people who are uninsured, and that number is 15% in D.C. So it literally halves the number, and that's just an example of how states being willing to commit their own dollars can really make a huge difference to that map. And so you have Virginia, where nobody even gets Medicaid expansion, whether they're an immigrant or not. You have Maryland, where they get Medicaid expansion, but not if they're not eligible for Medicaid based on their immigrant status. And then you have DC where the dam is well built and they really do a good job filling all the gaps.
So I'm originally from the capital of Virginia, Richmond, and I find this especially frustrating because Virginia is a very wealthy state. And they also pride themselves in making the state as hospitable to companies and businesses as possible with incredibly low tax rates for those businesses. So, you know, in my mind, I'm sitting here thinking if those tax rates were ever so slightly higher, we could be making sure that people actually have healthcare coverage, which, as we've talked about, is an actual human right that is necessary.
Yeah, and a lot of these solutions actually don't take many state tax dollars. The Medicaid expansion, right, is reimbursed. Eventually, it'll be reimbursed at a rate where the federal government's paying 90% of the cost. So it's not a huge commitment of state tax dollars to actually get tons of federal money to cover your state residents.
So if you're an immigrant corporation, Virginia is very hospitable.
I mean, corporations are people now, right? So absolutely.
They've always been people.
That's
we know
right.
that.
We know that.
It's amazing when you think about the fact that you could live. For people who don't know this area, we're in downtown Washington, D.C. It takes about 7 or 8 minutes by car to get to Virginia. I mean, it's very, very close.
And you can get on a bus line straight up to Silver Spring in Maryland.
Yeah. So we're talking about places that are really, really close. And whether you're here in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, is not a state, although
right.
you're right.
Great point.
It's
Great
functioning
point.
As a state. It just doesn't have any representation in Congress. It's a colony. But you go across the river, across the Potomac, and the same people, could be same family members, are deprived these basic guarantee, what should be guaranteed healthcare rights.
But this is not just here, right? I mean, this is, if you look at Portland, Oregon, and right across the border, there's the Vancouver suburbs in Washington State, same deal. You know, if you're immigrating up from Mexico and you're looking at California versus Texas borderlines, like I'm sure there are radically different policies going on there too.
So, but I can remember putting my hand on my heart and saying we were one nation indivisible, Leo.
Right, right. I mean, you do have a lot of other areas where this happens, right? I worked a long time in the Philly area, and you have right Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, all right next to each other. What makes this area pretty unique is that DC is like 99th percentile. It's like one of the 6 states in the whole country that solved this problem. And you have Virginia that's adopting policies that are kind of like the worst case southeastern red state policies that, you know, are least generous. So you have right next
contrast.
The starker contrast.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to some of the barriers for people who are immigrants in the immigrant population, a very vulnerable population, getting covered. Why are immigrant coverage rates so low?
Right. So even if you factor in that immigrants may not be eligible for as many programs, even when you look at the people who are eligible, it turns out that immigrants are eligible less often. And that, like, kind of the 4 dreaded words in my Medicaid policy world are eligible but not enrolled. But that is it's a problem across the board in Medicaid. But in the Latino, in the immigrant populations, it's a huge problem. Of every 3 Latino children who are uninsured, 2 of them are actually eligible.
Oh, wow.
Right? So this is like just huge numbers.
So what's happening?
There are a couple of things that are happening. And right now is a critical time on both of these issues, right? So the Trump administration stepping up deportations is a factor. And then this public charge guidance is a factor. So in terms of deportation, why is that important? Well, it turns out that many of the people who are immigrants and eligible for Medicaid are in a household where somebody is not, right? So mom is undocumented, but dad and the 3 kids are all citizens and could be eligible for Medicaid, could apply, could get into the program, but the family is afraid of applying because of this fear that the government's going to find out about mom and somebody's going to take mom away. And then now when you have the Trump administration overzealously enforcing immigration rules and crossing lines that were really rational policy lines that were drawn, right? So one of the things we've always told families is you can apply for health programs without fear because that is a line that we know that the government doesn't cross, right? And now when you have an administration that just crosses lines willy-nilly, it actually scares a lot of people. And so all of that time that we've spent kind of teaching immigrant communities that it's safe to apply for healthcare programs, that it's not going to endanger your family members, now it's really hard to say that. And the people on the front lines who are doing the work report that this is going the wrong way.
Wow, that's really, really atrocious.
Remember back in 2009, Joe Wilson, who was the congressman person from South Carolina, when Obama was making his speech before both houses of Congress, and Obama was making the point that the Affordable Care Act, which was then not yet passed, would not provide coverage for people who were not here legally. In other words, for the undocumented population. And Joe Wilson yelled out and became a hero of the Tea Party when he yelled, "You lie." Let's just talk about that. Now, you know, up until that point, when we were talking about how many people were uninsured in the United States, the number that was bandied about around 2009 and the motivation by the Obama administration was that there were about 50 million uninsured people. And then the number that started to be used more frequently was that there's like 30 or 35 million uninsured people, meaning the undocumented population sort of disappeared because the right wing was putting all this pressure trying to stop Affordable Care Act on the premise that people or the families and the children of undocumented people would be able to actually access Affordable Care Act. Just help us go through what happened there.
Yeah, so that's just totally wrong. Joe Wilson was himself lying. So the result of the Affordable Care Act, right, is to create a Medicaid expansion, which uses the exact same rules that all other Medicaid programs use, meaning that undocumented immigrants, and in fact, a whole bunch of other legal immigrants, student visas, business visas, are not eligible. Second, with respect to the marketplace, right, what the healthcare law did was both good and bad. One good thing the healthcare law did is it took a broader approach to who can actually purchase insurance and get subsidies. And instead of being the narrower list that Medicaid uses, which is not even all lawful immigrants, it said, okay, you know what? We're going to allow all lawful immigrants to purchase and get subsidies for insurance. But it was worse in that not only did it say that undocumented immigrants can't get subsidies, which was therefore Joe Wilson's lie, but it was in fact, under the law, the undocumented immigrants aren't even allowed to purchase into that private market paying full price themselves. So it's not just that they're not allowed to get subsidies, they can't even purchase on their own. So it's the equivalent of saying you can't go into the corner store and buy yourself a can of Coke, even if it's your money coming out of your pocket, you can't buy this insurance on this market, on this marketplace. So it was actually harder on undocumented immigrants than one could have, you know, than I would have even have guessed.
Besides what we're talking about with DC, for instance, as being perhaps a model, what are the bright spots, or you as a policy advocate, as an advocate for expanding healthcare, where are the bright spots right now?
Well, so there's one of the bright spots is clearly that the Affordable Care Act dramatically improved coverage in immigrant communities. If you look at, for example, the Latino community, yes, they are uninsured at higher rates than the white community, but that gap actually decreased significantly subsequent to the Affordable Care Act. So the Affordable Care Act did a lot of good things for Latino communities, for immigrant communities. It did not do a lot for the undocumented community. In fact, did nothing for the undocumented community in that sense. Nonetheless, we also see positives in the sense that there is more and more growing recognition that we have to get at all of the additional social factors that impact healthcare. So that's another thing that we're starting to see more conversations about. If there are immigrants who have experienced, for example, a really common story will be immigrants who experience great trauma to actually get to the United States, right? They come over the border in dangerous situations. Some of them have been, you know, drugged. Some of them have been held at gunpoint. They arrive in a country where they don't speak the language, where they don't know people. So they have this accumulated life trauma. And we've sort of figured out if you want to provide healthcare to them, you really have to hear about their story and start providing care that addresses that. So that's, you know, something that we're at least now acknowledging, if not yet anywhere near where we need to be on solving.
Well, that is a fascinating conversation, and we really appreciate you being here, Leo. We are totally out of time. We've been joined in studio by Leo Quio, an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. This is Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We've all heard about GMOs, or genetically modified foods, But new research has created what's being called GMO.2, or gene-edited food. What is this new creation, and is it any safer than GMO1? We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Patty Lovera, Food and Water Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. Patty, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is this? What are we talking about? Most people don't have a clue, I don't think.
Right. I think that's right. So gene editing is kind of the next generation of the, and there's several technologies that fit under that umbrella, you know, specific techniques. But essentially, we think it is still genetic engineering. We think it is worth being concerned about, and we have a lot of questions about whether our regulatory system here in the U.S. is prepared to handle this. You're essentially, it's just using new techniques to change the genetic material of plants or animals for a specific purpose. So it's lots and lots and lots of effort from the biotechnology industry is being put into portraying this as something different, because they're trying to avoid a lot of the baggage they have in the public relations arena from earlier technologies of genetic engineering.
From the point of food and water policy at the Food and Water Watch, do you consider GMO foods to be safe or unsafe?
We can't answer that because our regulatory system is so weak on these technologies. The first generation of GMOs, we know what they were using them for. Essentially, the main reason that crops were genetically engineered was so that you can grow them, corn or soybeans or, you know, whatever the crop is that's a GMO crop. So you can grow them and you can spray that field with a weed killer, often Roundup, and the weeds are supposed to die and the corn or the soy would live. So in addition to wondering about what the genetic change you made in that corn plant or in that soybean, we also have to worry about what does it mean that we're using so much more Roundup or now dicamba or some weed killer that's packaged to work with these GMO seeds, and our regulatory system doesn't ask the right questions to know that. We can't track if they're causing problems in people who eat those crops eventually because we don't label where the food goes. That's been a big battle. So we have lots and lots and lots of questions, and we don't have a regulatory system that lets us answer those questions.
Who's driving this technology? Is it farmers or agribusiness or Wall Street? Who's driving it?
So historically, you know, the kind of the first generation of GMOs was coming from big seed companies who happen to have been bought by big chemical companies. So you have Monsanto, you know, makes Roundup. They also sell you Roundup ready seeds. Dow and DuPont are now one company. They were big players. We're talking about whether Monsanto and Bayer are going to get together in a merger. They're big players in this industry. You know, there's a lot of, so there's kind of this biotechnology industry that's really gotten a stronghold over the seed industry. They're big drivers of it. And then there's a lot of defenders of this system in kind of the agribusiness world because they're using it. And so you get a lot from the food processing and the, you know, the crop side of those agribusiness companies who spend a lot of time and energy saying, there's nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. You know, just keep eating.
Right. Do you, as a person, eat or avoid GMO foods?
I mean, I try not to because I don't like lots of things about them. I don't like the business model. I mean, this is a business model. This technology has become a tool for corporate control over the basic building blocks of our food supply, the seeds. So, you know, there's a lot of patents involved. It raises the prices of seeds for farmers. I don't like that business model. I don't like the chemical use. It's not a coincidence that these chemical companies went out and bought seed companies so that they could genetically engineer the seeds so you use them with their chemicals. It is a chemical promoting system, which is bad for the environment, biodiversity. I think it's bad for the farmers and the farm workers who are handling those chemicals. And then I have a lot of questions about the food itself that I can't get great answers to because the companies themselves do the studies. So for all of those reasons, I think it's a bad move to be so reliant on this technology. There are ways to avoid it. Certified organic crops cannot use GMOs. So when you see the organic label, that is a GMO-free label. And then there's a growing portion of the market that is people are certifying it as non-GMO.
We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Patty Lovera. She's Food and Water Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. Patty, let's talk about how the seed companies are basically taking over, dominating, controlling smaller farmers and have essentially carried out monopoly type practices. How does that work?
So, I mean, monopoly is probably the right word. What we've seen, and this is true of really every step in the food chain, but it's really egregious at this kind of input level, the seeds and the chemicals and the fertilizers that farmers go out and buy. We've seen a lot of mergers and just small companies being pushed out or acquired, and then what's left is the products being offered by these big companies. So it's a real question of whether farmers even have a choice of something different, or are they just choosing between the two or three big players who are all offering, you know, expensive patented GMO seeds that are packaged to go with these chemicals, and often they're cross-licensing these things to each other, so you may not even have that many choices. So there's been a real buildup in that consolidation in that step, and so that raises the prices for farmers, but it also reduces the choice for farmers. There is enough interest in the marketplace now because of all this bad PR for GMOs. The non-GMO segment is growing pretty fast, so it seems like farmers are doing a little better. They have a few more options because that marketplace is growing. But for years, we heard from farmers they couldn't find non-GMO seeds at all, let alone in the varieties they needed or at the price they needed. And they really had to do an extraordinary amount of effort to get out of that GMO system.
And the point that you also made a moment ago, that it really induces the use of heavy-duty chemicals in agriculture. We have seed companies being purchased by chemical companies who then match these seeds or the crops that come from those seeds to being resistant to the use, say, of Roundup or other really, really, really powerful insecticides or pesticides. Thus, it has those crops growing in spite of being sort of drenched in chemicals. But it does have a profound impact in terms of biodiversity as a consequence, right? Just explain how that works and what its significance is.
There's that first generation of the genetically engineered crops kind of hit the market in the mid-90s in the U.S., and it's been pretty rapid adoption. So we're now looking at, you know, the vast majority of acres of corn and soy, especially in the U.S., are GMO, and they are herbicide resistant, right? You can spray them with these weed killers. So that has changed a couple things. It has actually changed kind of the landscape of farms. It enabled farmers to kind of go fence row to fence row even tighter. And maybe there used to be some milkweed on the edge of the field that was allowed to be there. But now, you know, it's not hard labor to pull that up anymore. You can spray it with the Roundup and plant more corn right up to the edge. So that's habitat for somebody like butterflies. And then there's a lot of debate about the impact that the chemicals are having on insects, pollinators, whatever it might be, from spraying it itself. And so, again, this stuff was promoted. I mean, Roundup was promoted as this very benign chemical, lower on the kind of ladder of toxicity and impacts than everything we had used before, and tremendous amounts of it were used when it was linked with this technology. Now we have weeds that are resistant to Roundup. Like, nature evolves, right? And so the ones that were able to survive being sprayed with Roundup, they're the ones that reproduced. And so now there are large parts of the country where farmers can't use Roundup anymore. They have to use something different, and they're resorting to older, possibly more toxic, you know, tougher weed killers because the Roundup's not working anymore. So the image that people use is of a treadmill, and we talk about the treadmill going faster, the chemical treadmill, and it's just this cycle, kind of always solving the next problem with the next chemical.
Yeah, Penny, of course, agribusiness and the companies like Monsanto or others that are advocates for this kind of farming and this kind of food production will say, well, guess what? It's going to allow us to have cheaper food and feed an ever-growing population on the planet. Of course, when one looks at corporate structures, you don't think that they're in it for any other reason than simply to make money. They're looking to investors. They're trying to maximize profits by the quarter because that's how they're evaluated and judged, not based on feeding hungry people or making food affordable to people who don't have much money. Obviously, the system has a profound sort of foundational flaw in it. Are there other models outside, perhaps outside the United States or elsewhere, that are the kind of thing that you're looking to promote as an alternative?
Yeah, there's folks all over the world. I mean, the U.S. is probably the biggest adopter of GMOs. There are other countries who do use a lot of them, Canada, Brazil, but lots of the world does not use them in the way that we're doing it. And there's lots of models to look at. So in the U.S., there are folks who are not growing GMOs. Certified organic cannot. So they use different methods. They can't go use Roundup to solve their problem. And there's lots of techniques around the world where folks are spending less money and doing different things and not just growing one thing like corn is a big start.
Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. We want to continue this discussion. Everybody cares about what we eat and how it gets to our table. Anyway, we've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Patty Lovera. She is Food and Water Policy Director at Food and Water Watch here in Washington. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. and the U.K. issued a joint technical alert this week, which says that Russia has hacked millions of personal and home technological devices. Is this really true? What's the big picture? And how do we know? We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garafo. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Walter and Brian. Great to talk to you. Thanks for having me back.
So it's pretty unusual, maybe even unprecedented, for two states to attribute a cyber attack to another state. What do you think is behind that decision?
Well, just for a little background, this alert came from the U.S. CERT. It's the Computer Emergency Readiness Team, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, and the U.K.'s National Cybersecurity Center. Both of their alerts provide a lot of information about what they accuse the Russians, kind of in quotes, of doing, but very little proof other than saying that they've been monitoring the situation since 2014 or 2016, depending on who you ask. This is, of course, just part of the broader anti-Russia sentiment in the United States, part of the Russiagate scandal that's certainly been fueling it. I don't see any basis for this, and more to the point, I don't see any proof, actually, coming from any of these agencies that the Russian government is involved. And we should specify that, yes, there are hacker groups independent in Russia and in every country around the world. But the way this is always phrased is that it's the Russian government that's involved.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about these cyber attacks in general. I mean, there was something that happened. What are the motivations for different groups, whether it be states or, like you're saying, you know, independent groups of criminals, I guess, who carry out these types of activities?
For independent groups, some of it is just because they can. Some of it is to take over computer networks and basically creates farms of computers that they can control to attack other systems, to send out spam, to even mine for Bitcoin to make them, you know, to make money. Sometimes they attack companies, as we saw earlier this year and late last year, with ransomware that locks down a system until you pay a ransom. That's independent groups. Now, when it comes to governments, every government has a cybersecurity defense and offense team, and they use them for spying.
Okay, so that's independent groups, and what about governments?
Governments use these capabilities essentially for spying and or for espionage and to launch offensive attacks as well. We know that, for example, the Stuxnet virus that attacked Iranian nuclear facilities came from the U.S. and Israel. That was back in 2011. And we know that the U.S. is frequently involved in attacking other governments' networks for spying purposes. There was actually a story in late January in the Dutch newspaper Volkskrant, which effectively was making a case against Russia for somehow supporting independent hacker groups. But right in the middle of it, very nonchalantly, they mention that it was actually the Dutch government and U.S. government that hacked into the Russian government systems and university systems to sort of get their proof of this. And of course, it was, you know, all about Russia hacking, but then they just mentioned that it was the U.S. and Dutch that actually hacked into Russian systems and essentially boasted about it.
Is it fair to say, Chris, that most governments are involved in cyber attacks or this kind of hacking? I mean, if you know, I mean, maybe you don't know, but what's your sense of it?
I would say that most of the world powers, the imperialist countries, the large capitalist countries, are involved in this sort of offensive work. Of course, the largest offender is the United States government. We know from the CIA Vault 7 released by WikiLeaks last year that we saw that the CIA has their own cybersecurity offensive team that has so many tools. And I think the important one here is that they have many tools that can sort of hide where the attacks come from and make them look like they're coming from a different place. That applies here in that attacks can look like they're coming from Russia to other systems. I'm not trying to say the CIA hacked U.S. systems, but that they can use those tools to attack other nations and other systems and make it look like it came from Russia.
Yeah, I'm looking also, let's go back to the context here, because Americans are being scared witless of Russia or directed to have animus or hostility towards Russia. And there's certain parts of these allegations about attacking and cyber attacking that seem very ominous. And we're also all learning about the army of Russian bots that are employed presumably by the Kremlin or the Russians. And of course, that, as you mentioned, Chris, that becomes kind of a generic, really an ethnic profiling term. There was an article in the New York Times yesterday about why Trump had decided to postpone the announcement on sanctions, or perhaps not go forward with the announcement. And the article made the point that at the time that Trump was making decisions, that there was this vast increase of trolling by Russian bots. And then today in this, you know, let's see what page this is. This is page A19 at the very, very bottom. There's a correction, and I want to read it to you. Again, nobody's going to see this. I saw it, but that was by accident. Because I buy the hard copy of the New York Times, Walter. Walter's never held a physical newspaper.
Not once.
Generationally.
Not ever once.
Okay. Here's what it says. An article on Tuesday about President Trump's decision to reject new sanctions against Russia, relying on information provided by a senior official at the Department of Homeland Security, referred incorrectly to an increase of Russian online trolling activity that occurred around the time the United States launched airstrikes against Syria. The increase was noted among Russian hashtags, not bots. Additionally, the information should not have been attributed to the department's spokesman. I mean, wow, that's Russian hashtags versus Russian bots, quite a big difference. And yet this information is coming to the media from the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, you know, Brian, I haven't gotten to page A19 myself either today, so even I haven't seen that. I think we see they're completely stepping back. They're, like you're saying, they're putting out this idea that it was Russian bots and then retracting it the next day, whether that was an intentional leak by the source or by the New York Times.
Quite a big difference between a hashtag, a Russian hashtag, and a Russian bot, though, right?
Absolutely. A hashtag is somebody just posting a tweet on Twitter or on Facebook and using a hashtag. And there was a lot of activity on Twitter around the time of the attacks on Syria, and the Russian people certainly had every right and reason to be concerned, because the Russian military is assisting in the operations in Syria against the terrorists.
Yeah, and Chris, the presentation now is that Russians obviously don't exist except in bot form, or people who are operating bots. I mean, it's really something. Of course Russia cares about what's happening, and of course Russians care about what's happening in Syria. And of course, people are going to go online and use hashtags from Russia or that include the word Russia. And yet the Americans are being spoon-fed this idea that there's this, you know, diabolical conspiracy with Russian bots to do all things, including the influence on President Trump's decision not to go forward with sanctions. Again, Russian bots. I mean, it's just amazing. 2 minutes left. Go ahead.
We should talk about hypocrisy, actually, in this case, because we know that actually there are bots coming from the Israeli government all the time. The Israeli military actually has an online response team, people who literally sit in a room and respond to anything critical of Israel. I would call them bots, but no one ever talks about that. That's, you know, part of the response here that we have to be aware of, that this is not a Russian thing. And like you said earlier, just saying Russian itself actually just invalidates, you know, the millions of Russian citizens.
So again, let's talk about Vault 7, which this is again from WikiLeaks, a WikiLeaks revelation. The CIA lost control of the majority of its hacking arsenal, including malware, viruses, trojans, weaponized zero-day exploits, malware, remote control systems, and associated documentation. The extraordinary collection, this is from WikiLeaks, which amounts to more than several hundred million lines of code, gives its processor the entire hacking capacity of the CIA. Really quite something. They lost control of it. But those tools were designed to be able to make it appear that any other entity that the CIA or NSA, I would guess, wanted to attribute a hacking operation, they could make it do that. In other words, it would look like it was in Cyrillic, Russian, or in Mandarin, Chinese, or in Arabic, or Farsi, Iran. That's what we're talking about here, right? This is the capability that the CIA and U.S. intelligence agencies actually have to mask their own operations. So we actually would never know.
That's right. We can never definitively say, and even the U.S. government agencies and British agencies in this case say that they only have high confidence, which means that they can't be 100% sure. They can't be entirely sure. And we may never know who's behind this. But I can almost certainly say that it is not the Russian government. I can say that with high confidence, just based on the evidence that we've seen so far and the lack of evidence that has been put forward with these accusations.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We're out of time. We've been joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
So it's Friday again. We'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Maybe some of them are funny. I think the first one's pretty funny. Some of them are just really, really terrible and misleading. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks.
So, Steve, what are we looking at for this week's headlines?
Well, let's start with a funny one just to get the mood going. This one is from CNN. It reads, Airmen fired, demoted, over dinosaur puppet video.
Dinosaur puppet video?
That certainly got my attention.
Court-martialed or just fired?
No, they were demoted, relieved of their position. A young woman, maybe she's not so young, was taking her reenlistment oath in the Air Force. And while she was doing that, raising her right hand, on her right hand, is a puppet of a dinosaur.
I think it's pretty great.
She thought this was pretty funny. I do, too.
So the hand puppet was taking the oath? Is that what she was doing? The commander was saying, repeat after me, and she had this hand puppet dinosaur repeating after him? Is that what this was?
Something like that, apparently, yes.
And the Pentagon doesn't like that?
I guess they don't like that.
No, it was embarrassing to the time-honored military tradition, which, you know, is about killing people and stuff like that, not about being silly.
I think this part is super bizarre, and I don't entirely get, but what I think is hilarious is that she was, well, it's not hilarious she was fired, but it is hilarious the reason she was fired was because she was showing disrespect to, quote, the traditions and sanctity of the military.
What's the sanctity of the military? What does that mean?
The sanctity
no
of
puppets?
Murder?
No dinosaur puppets.
That's what it is. No dinosaur puppets, yeah.
Is it just no puppets or it's the dinosaur? What triggered this?
We'll have to get an investigative reporter on that.
Maybe next week we'll follow up. We'll see what happened to these poor people.
See what I can find out.
Don't make jokes when you're reciting your oath for your re-induction for the National. What is it? The Tennessee Air National Guard. They just don't like the dinosaur hand puppet thing.
No.
Let's go on to another headline.
Well, here in Silicon Valley, we're very concerned with corporate security.
When you say we, who do you mean? Are you?
No, I mean everyone around me here. Not me personally, but certainly all the companies like Apple, which is just a few blocks away from where I am right now. And this headline is about Apple, and it reads, leaked Apple memo demands that employees stop leaking its memos.
Oh, God, but this one got out, too.
Okay, that's pretty... Who wrote that? Oh, that's the Mercury News.
Yes, it's the San Jose Mercury News, a local newspaper. The scary part of the story, actually, is that the Apple reported that it caught 29 leakers last year and 12 of them were arrested.
Yeah, that part's a little creepy. I don't know why we're arresting people for leaking Apple memos.
Not beheaded.
And it doesn't. There's no indication of what they were arrested for, so I don't exactly know.
It seems like maybe they should go for, I don't know, like smoke signals or intercom announcements, something that's not a memo maybe next time. I don't know.
So anyway, we can't keep control of the Apple. The Apple memos are leaking and the memo about leaking leaked. Anyway, but that doesn't sound, you know, that doesn't sound that unusual. I mean, when you think about what's going on in Washington, D.C., Like everything, this ship is leaking.
Memos are designed to leak.
There's hardly buoyancy here because of so much leaking. Not buoyant. Steve, let's go on. Let's get another headline.
Well, let's go to this first one here, which is just came out a few minutes ago. U.S. brands China and Russia forces of instability.
That's in quotes.
The funny one. This is just an outrageous one. And this is a State Department basically press release. And the headline's actually a little misleading because if you read the article, it's not just China and Russia. It's also Iran and North Korea. Those are all forces of instability according to the U.S. State Department. The U.S. State Department, which is part of a government which is currently bombing seven other countries, funding insurgents who are trying to overthrow other countries and so on. But China and Russia and Iran and North Korea, which are doing none of those things, they're the forces of instability in the world. It's really just a topsy-turvy kind of
I wish
situation.
John was here because he would say, in his CIA training that you deny, 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 and then say exactly what your criticisms are. Say those to other people, right? And that's what we're doing here. The U.S.
Brands China and Russia forces of instability. So just think, let's be serious about this, Nicole and Steve.
Fine.
Let's take a moment and let's be serious. Let's imagine, for instance, that if Russia or China invaded a Middle Eastern country with hundreds of thousands of troops, overthrew the government. Of course, that could be a destabilizing event for that country and perhaps the region. That could happen. That did happen. That actually is what the United States did in Iraq. Not only did 1 million people die in Iraq, that's according to the Lancet Medical Journal, not only did Iraq fragment as a country. Iraq had always been together. It wasn't divided based on ethno-sectarian division. It's completely fragmented. Iraq not only did not have ISIS, but the entire region was relatively stable before that event. There could be no single event in modern times that was more destabilizing, not just to a country, but to a region, than the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And here we have the gall of the U.S. State Department branding Russia and China as forces of instability. You can call Russia and China a lot of things, of course, and the U.S. calls Russia and China almost everything. But the idea that the United States exempts or immunizes itself as a destabilizing force by attributing this feature to others, I mean, it's the worst kind of demagoguery. But sadly, because the Democrats and Republicans are all singing from the same American exceptionalism hymnal, this is going to go over okay. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, it'll just be read out loud by news anchors on all the channels, and people will hear that without any countervailing information, like the information you were just providing.
Okay, I see another headline here that I have to say I haven't read the article, but it's Hillary Clinton, they were never going to let me be president.
That's a quote from Clinton on election night as exit polls came in. And this is actually according to a new book by a political reporter who followed her.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was wondering, Brian. Who is they in this sense? It never says exactly who they is, whether she's positing some conspiracy theory. I think probably she's talking about the American people is they.
I'm sure she's specifically targeting bucket of deplorables.
Maybe she was talking about the Electoral College because she actually did win the popular vote. So maybe she's angry at the Electoral College, but I'm guessing that that's not what she, I mean, it says so much about who Hillary Clinton is. I mean, everyone thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. Donald Trump thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. Certainly the entire political establishment thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. Guess what? Russia thought Hillary Clinton was going to win too. Like nobody expected, well, not nobody, almost no one expected this to happen. And yet Hillary Clinton, she could blame James Comey the week before the election. She could blame the Russians the week after and since. She could blame Bernie Sanders. Remember, Bernie Sanders created divisions because he ran. She blamed Jill Stein because Jill Stein existed.
And third-party
voters
generally.
Because third parties are allowed to exist in America, even though they're weakened. She blamed everybody, but now they would never let me win.
I think the key sentence in this article is this, which is that Clinton knew she was never going to be able to win some voters over. And of course, what's interesting about that is the voters she was trying to win. She could have won, say, a lot of more of the Sanders voters over if she had been willing to change her policies, perhaps, for example, come out for a $15 minimum wage, just to name one thing, which she adamantly resisted.
But she doesn't have any progressive bones in her body, so that would never happen.
But she doesn't, exactly. And instead, she tried to go to the right and try to win over, quote unquote, moderate Republican voters. So it was, in the end, it was her strategy and who she, you know, what she, how she positioned her campaign, which caused her to lose. Not, she wasn't never going to be able to win some voters over. Well, never, unless she was a different person and a different candidate. So basically, it's her implicit acknowledgement that she couldn't change and she was who she was, and take me or leave me. And I guess the American people, at least in the electoral college sense, that will leave you.
She expected a coronation, and she's angry that she, that it didn't happen.
We've got to go. We skipped this headline last week, and it's just my favorite.
We only have 2 minutes, so
make it good, right?
Go ahead.
Why Wells Fargo is about to be punished again. And in the article, is this too much punishment? I mean, poor Wells Fargo.
Oh my God.
They might face a $1 billion fine, which obviously would be so problematic for an organization, a company that makes...
Could you pass the Kleenex over? I'm starting to tear up.
$97 billion gross profit in 2017 alone. I don't know how they're going to survive losing one of those billions. But don't worry. Don't worry. At his own recommendation, the CEO is not taking a cash bonus this year. He's just going to get a 36% raise, but he's not taking a cash bonus at all. So, you know, his $17 million.
Oh, it's $17 million. I don't even know how I can get by on that. Hey, Steve, we have less than 1 minute left. I mean, okay, here's this one. Mattis, that would be James Mad Dog Mattis, quote, has become a secret peacenik in the Trump White House, and he's growing more isolated.
What?
That's okay, but that might be true. I mean, that's the wow. When somebody, Mad Dog Mattis, who said before he likes shooting people, is now the secret peacenik in the White House. Go ahead, Steve, take us out.
Well, when he's actually advocating for withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan and stop drone bombing people in many other countries, then we'll take the word peacenik a little more seriously.
But every time another U.S. fighter jet bombs, say, a place in Syria, I can just hear Mattis in the background singing Kumbaya, because yeah, because I think that's the secret side of Mad Dog.
Steve, your best one this week. UN chief says Cold War is back.
Yeah. What was his first clue?
What was your first clue?
What was the first clue?
Unfortunately, Steve, we're out of time. We've been joined by Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. And you can hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Oh,